Hello and welcome. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the E-commerce Gold Podcast. It's always a pleasure to have you tune in. I really appreciate it when you do. And you've chosen a fantastic episode to listen to today. It's Rob, arguably the number one lawyer or solicitor in the UK in the e-commerce and consumer space. He's a freelance now. He's worked at a big firm before, and he dedicates his time to some of the things that really annoy us in the e-commerce industry, like ADA compliance and subscription terms and conditions. But also, we get into a bit of a deeper conversation about how and why laws are made for the space, how you get things changed if you want to make some changes to the law, and generally speaking, is it good or bad for consumer to have all these laws? Where's it going next with things like AI? All of those topics and more are found in this episode. About an hour long, a little bit all over the place, but altogether very interesting, at least for me. And I appreciate Rob coming on the show and sharing what he knows about law in this space, specifically for the US and even more specifically around California, but applicable perhaps worldwide. This show, as always, is brought to you by Sendlane, the company that power emails, SMS, and give you reviews for free for D2C e-commerce brands. They are a fantastic solution for email, a fantastic solution for SMS, and a fantastic solution for reviews, all bundled up into a very, very cost-competitive offering. And the team, I say this a lot, is incredible, pioneering. Nothing can stop these guys at this point. You probably already had a demo with them. You might already be switching over to them. You might already use them. But if you do not, it's well worth checking them out. Google Sendlane and go and book yourself a demo, or at least watch a YouTube video or two about what they're all about. And Rewind, the company that protects your Shopify store from anything going wrong, from losing any data. It's essentially a backup button that's constantly looking at your store, saving all your order history, customer information, product information, everything like that, as well as your theme and all your code base and everything. And then if you have to restore something because you messed something up, or an app is conflicted with something, or for whatever reason, you just need a previous version of your store, maybe yesterday's version, a week ago, who knows, you can click a button and it's there restored for you. Nothing more said. Now, that's a problem that could last weeks and add incredible amounts of stress to your life if you don't have it there. So do have it there. And then they also offer things like staging sites so you can make all of your changes. Maybe you're going to try a new checkout. Maybe you're going to try and change a button color. Maybe you're going to try and implement a new app. It could be anything. Maybe you're going to do a massive data migration. You're going to try splitting out some data or launch a new store in a different language. I don't know. But do it on a staging site first. Don't do it anywhere near your live environment. And only once you're happy and actually you've checked all of your laws and that you're legally abiding all of the laws that are out there, then move it to your live environment and then carry on as normal. It's just great, good practice to have a staging site and a live environment sat separate from each other. Rewind give you the ability to have a constantly updated version of each so that you don't have to manually update and pay a developer lots of money to maintain your staging environment. Rewind do all of that for you. So check out Rewind on the App Store, in Shopify, or just Google. Links to both of those in the show notes below. Over to you, Rob. Rob, thank you so much for joining us today on the Ecom Gold Podcast. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Very well indeed. Please, a bit of a different guest today to our traditional founders and operators. Can you explain to everybody who doesn't already know who you are, what you do, what you have been doing for at least the last, how long have you been practicing? 5, 10 years?
This is my 12th year now. So
12th year.
Decent Fantastic. Amount of time. Yeah, I'm an advertising and e-commerce attorney. My clients primarily are direct-to-consumer brands, marketing agencies, and then maybe 15% or so of my client base is individual talent and creators. And what I focus on doing is helping those clients avoid litigation about things that have to do with their ads. So for the first 7 years of my career, first 7 years I was practicing, or slightly under 7 years, I was at a big law firm doing litigation defense work. And a lot of the work that I was doing was defending big companies from consumer class actions in California. A lot of that, those class actions have to do with advertising issues. So that was my exposure to the world of advertising law generally. And when it was time to leave that firm and I decided to start my own practice, I wanted to help clients avoid those sorts of cases that I was dealing with constantly before they got to that stage. And that's what I do now primarily. I also help with related transactional work like contract drafting and review if you're a brand hiring an agency or vice versa, or working with any of your vendors. I also work closely with a colleague who helps our clients with stuff like entity structuring. If you're starting a new LLC or corporation, or if you're absorbing one, or if you want to have your brand protected with trademarks and things like that, my colleague Jeff handles that part of the practice, and together we cover a fair amount of ground.
Yeah, sounds like it. So take us back a little bit to that when you were working at this big firm. Mm-hmm. What can you just explain a bit more about the cases that you were working on? What was actually being talked about or resolved?
Yeah, so in California is one of the states that has the most consumer class action activity in the U.S. And so one of the categories, so the way it works essentially is one consumer alleges some sort of violation of the law in a sort of simple case and one that comes up a lot. This product was advertised as being marked down from $100 to $70. Turns out it was never actually offered for $100. So I, the consumer, was misled by this. I wouldn't have bought the product if I knew the truth. And so I'm going to sue you on behalf of myself and behalf of every consumer who bought your product for the last 4 years. We're going to pool that purchase price damages figure together and demand that amount plus attorney's fees. Essentially create a huge problem for a business.
Wow.
And then defending those types of cases, that's just one example, but that's representative of the sort of thing that would come up not infrequently. And so then it was our job to figure out what the plan is. Is there an opportunity for, you know, first of all, did we actually do what we're accused of doing? We'd always say that, like, you think of the lawyer and the client as the same thing when you're trying to strategize. But like, did our client actually do what they're accused of doing? If so, what does the claim look like? Is it worth exploring a settlement here? Typically, the answer is yes. And then if that's not something that happens, I mean, you prepare to take it all the way to trial if you have to. And, you know, we can talk about what that process looks like too, but, cases like that, it's one upset consumer finds a lawyer, or often the other way around, and tries to make a run at putting a class together and making it a big problem.
Would you say, generally speaking, that it's predatory behavior from the wounded consumer, i.e. they don't really mind that much, but they in fact maybe spot an opportunity? And has that become more of a kind of industry now? Are there people looking to do these things? What's your opinion on that? Is that okay? Are they just sort of holding these companies accountable to the letter of the law? Do you think that's all right? I'm just interested, like, this culture that I guess has emerged from that. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I see both sides of it. I think that depending on the nature of the claim we're talking about, some appear to be more obviously predatory than others. Like website ADA compliance. To me, the concept that you can just, you know, an enterprising lawyer can find one visually impaired person, and that person can just spend all day going to e-commerce websites or other internet sites and then file hundreds of lawsuits claiming that this website's not, you know, accessible in the way it's supposed to be. And that seems especially predatory to me. I don't think that is what the drafters of the ADA had in mind when they put that law together. And if they had foreseen that it would be exploited in that way, perhaps they would have put some limitations on it. On the other hand, the tension is, like, if the reason we have class actions as a mechanism in the first place is because if you weren't able to aggregate these claims, nobody's going to go to court over like $2. If I was promised a $2 discount or something, or if the price of the product is $2 and you lied to me about what it does, I'm out $2. No one's ever going to go to court for that. So if we don't have this process, then we would never be able to hold brands accountable, because it's not like the FTC is going to be everywhere at once. And so we're sort of relying on consumers to fill in the gaps and keep things fair. On the other hand, to your question, are there people out there that have developed systems designed just to exploit the class action mechanism? Like, are there lawyers out there who are just looking for clients who are willing to say, okay, yeah, I'm really upset about this, go ahead and put my name on that lawsuit? Absolutely, that is happening every day. And it's hard to know exactly in which case this consumer is actually really upset, or is it one where somebody's just looking for maybe a little bit of a payday and it's actually lawyer driven. But there's certainly an industry of plaintiff side lawyers who, they're the ones trying to identify what the either technical or more substantive legal violations are, figuring out who's doing it, and then doing something like running an Instagram campaign. Like, did you sign up for Bumble, for example? Fill out this form and maybe you'll get some money. And then you're off to the races if you find one person. And that machinery is something that is increasingly popular. I mean, it's not going away anytime soon. So all of that to say, I can understand why we have the systems that we do, but certainly it's one that's ripe for exploitation if you're on that side of the fence.
Yeah, and people in our industry, e-commerce and consumer, especially brand side, get irate about, especially the example you gave with the ADA stuff. But who's really at fault? I mean, to some degree, though, everyone's acting within the law. That machinery exists, and maybe they are exploiting something that shouldn't necessarily morally be exploited, but it's within the law. So, okay, you know, no problem there. The brands are doing their best. And obviously, I know it's especially with the ADA example, it's almost impossible to be 100% compliant as far as I'm aware. So we're in that vortex, because it feels like a downward death spiral for the brands involved, and like you said, not going away anytime soon. So who cleans that up, and how does that actually get cleaned up? Like, surely in this day and age, there's a process that might take a certain amount of time, but how does that actually change?
Yeah, well, one way it changes is you can look at, this is one of the rare examples where I can say California did something pro-business. But those ADA claims don't work if you file them in California courts anymore, because the judges out here have said, if you're going to bring one of those claims against an entity that doesn't have a brick and mortar presence, that's an online only business, then we don't think that's what these lawmakers had in mind when they wrote this, and we're not going to allow those claims to proceed here. And so that door closed in California state and federal courts. What it took was just those judges agreeing, this is where we're drawing the line, and that's, we're not going to have that here anymore. In Pennsylvania, and I don't know if New York still does this, but I know for sure in Pennsylvania, those judges are saying, yeah, you don't need a brick and mortar nexus. These claims can proceed against these businesses out here. That's why you see so many of these filed in Pennsylvania now, because the lawyers know where to go to make this still work. So one way to have it change is having enough judges align on this interpretation of this law and coming down on the side of ideally that you want, that like, no, this is not what this was supposed to do. This, we're stretching it too far by allowing these things, these claims to proceed against businesses in this way. The other way is much more, or one other way, takes a lot longer, especially when you're dealing with a federal law, and that is lobbying to have your legislators either amend the law or repeal it or whatever, and essentially just rewrite the law, which, you know, does happen. It's somewhat easier to do that at the state level. And I don't claim to be an expert on how this process works. I know people who have successfully lobbied for changes in the law at the state level, but I don't know exactly how the process works. But that's really it. I mean, you have either judges decide that they're not going to allow a certain type of claim anymore or interpret a law a certain way. You can revise or repeal a law, or you can champion your legislature to write something new that fixes something that's a problem as you see it.
I just want to go into that a bit more then. So firstly, the judges who decide to interpret and use the law in a different way, that to me sounds, and this might be the case internationally, and I'm just unaware, but that sounds to me, so we place a lot of confidence in our judges' interpretation of the law. I think in the UK, at least, in criminal cases, maybe civil too, the law is based on previous convictions or previous, and then they're quoted often in the judgment. They'll quote a previous case, and that's how they got to where they are. And they work within parameters, I believe. You know that they a certain offense can only carry certain parameters, and then they look back on previous judgments and they try and come up with some kind of appropriate sentencing. That's a very loose of what happens in the UK. So, do the judges have a bit more control in the US? I.e., they have the ability to be more opinionated, and it sounds like en masse. But isn't that dangerous? Like, who controls that? Because surely at that point you could just influence those judges and get them to interpret the law in a slightly different way, which sounds like they've sort of done in California here for good or bad. You know, who knows? Depends what side you're on.
Yeah, do they have, how much control do they have as a starting point? So there's a tiered system, and essentially the if we're talking about federal courts, they're broken up into what we call circuits. The country's divided into these circuits that are clusters of states, and they have their courts of appeal that cover that territory. So in California, we have the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal. When issues are appealed, issues of law are appealed to the Ninth Circuit, and we get a panel of appellate judges to essentially weigh in and tell us what the law is. From then on, all of the lower courts, like if you go to court and file a case, you're in district court, in federal court anyway. So whatever legal issues those judges are looking at, if the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has weighed in, the district court judges are bound by whatever the Court of Appeals said. And they're in turn bound by whatever the Supreme Court said if the issue has been addressed by them. If it's an issue where there's not binding appellate law on it, for example, like was Title III of the ADA designed to apply to a business that has no physical location, that's online only? The courts of appeal hadn't addressed that question before. So at the time, it's like the lawyers make the argument that yes, you have to provide a reasonable accommodation, and that means having your website accessible, or no, this part of the law suggests that what we're supposed to have, that it's not supposed to apply to something that's online only. And so you have judges coming out differently on that. And then what it takes is someone who's unhappy with one of those decisions to file their appeal to the Ninth Circuit, who will then give you that appellate guidance. And in those situations, it's not one judge, but it's multiple of them. So is it possible that you could somehow, you know, influence multiple appellate justices at the federal level to come down on an issue of like website accessibility? I don't want to say nothing's impossible, but you know, they decide so many things every year, and I like to think that I've certainly never heard of, and I also haven't researched it, but I haven't heard of a federal judge being bribed on a certain issue, at least not in modern times. So, you know, ultimately everyone's human, but I think we do a pretty good job of ensuring that personal bias is checked to the extent that we can. And it's not like the dice roll was on this one judge and the entire issue of liability in this very, on this issue that affects so many people, it comes down to one person's opinion. There's a little bit more checked and balanced than that.
But it does differ by state, right? So that group of judges in California made that decision, but the ones in Pennsylvania presumably made a different decision.
So the judges that sit in California on the Court of Appeals made a decision that will affect a group of states that are within the Ninth Circuit. So it's California, Nevada, Arizona, Oregon, Washington. I can't remember if there's any more, and that's a different appellate circuit than what Pennsylvania is in, which is, I believe, the Third Circuit. So if there's a difference between those courts of appeal, then that's the sort of question that could be one for the Supreme Court to resolve. Like, if you get enough decisions that are coming out that are butting heads, and there's the right case that's been decided by one of those courts of appeal, where the Supreme Court would say, like, all right, we should opine on this because the country's divided and it comes up a lot and it's important and it's worth weighing in on. That's how that would happen if it's something that the Supreme Court thought was important enough to provide clarity on.
And who drives that? If it got to that extent, would that be a particular branding question that is particularly unsatisfied or satisfied with a certain way that a case went, that would then take the responsibility, shoulder that responsibility to try and make that happen? Or is there a catchment process? Someone's watching and looking at, like you said, these different outcomes from different states, and it hits a certain amount, and then they say, okay, we'll review that.
Yeah. So anyone in that situation who has had an appellate decision that is then appealable, like, you have the right to submit or essentially petition the Supreme Court to hear your case. I think it's something like 98% of those are denied. Like, the Supreme Court is very selective in which cases they take up. The process of how you could potentially lobby for the Supreme Court to take your case up, even if there is the potential for that, I admit I don't know. It's been a long time since I took constitutional law in school, and I really don't know how that process works. I'm sure there's a lot of lobbying that goes on behind the scenes and a lot that we're not privy to, but I honestly don't know. But I know that the starting point would be the losing party in some appellate case takes it upon themselves to file that petition to ask the Supreme Court to hear the issue.
Interesting. And then the other one, lobbying, to have law changed. Like, does that happen? Do brands have the power to change laws? Like Nike, for example, or Google?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And this is actually a conversation I was having within the last month. I don't know how it works, but I do know that it happens and that it has successfully happened multiple times. So there was a, what was the example I was going to give? And let me do this so that I'm not outing whoever it was, but there's a automobile manufacturer that was facing a lot of financial trouble in litigation because of some issue with a component of their vehicle that was failing, and they were continually being sued about it and continually losing at trial to the tune of multiple millions of dollars. And so they wanted to stem that tide. And one of the ways they thought that they could ease the pressure of these huge verdicts was to try to cap the amount of attorney's fees that are available in those sorts of cases in California, so that if you disincentivize the lawyers bringing it, maybe they won't bring as many, or maybe, you know, the verdicts that juries are going to award, it's going to take the heat off of us a bit. So it's like, if we can't fix the problem with the vehicle, maybe we can change the law so that, like, it's less appealing to bring this kind of case, as just one example. And if it happened then, I'm sure it happens all the time. I'm sure that there's efforts going on as we speak on behalf of some large company to get a law changed in California that favors whatever that constituency is. And not all for bad. I'm sure that there are also groups out there that are lobbying for things that we both would agree are worthy things to lobby for and have changed in the law. But that's the extent of what I know. I really don't know how it all works or how I would get that started if I wanted to, but there is an opportunity to have to get the ear of people who could write the law the way that you want it.
Yeah, sounds like it. It's an interesting dynamic that you have in the States. Maybe it's further afield, but lobbying, you hear a lot. Sean posts, I think somewhat sarcastically on Twitter, about how he's going to lobby certain governments to do certain things for Ridge. I don't know how that all works, but yeah, it does sound, I mean, at the base layer, at least how I interpret it, is you're able to, when you reach a certain status or have a certain amount of money, you're able to contribute to certain things, which lends you ear time with the right people, which could ultimately and eventually result in favorable laws being created in your direction, as long as they're not too extreme. I don't know, but you know, from an outsider looking in, that's roughly how I interpret it. Is that sort of along the right path as you would?
I think that's a good summary of what the opportunity is. If you're big enough and influential enough and have enough money to spend, then you can get some ear time and your voice can be heard much more loudly than someone else's. And that could affect the change that you want.
I imported a bulk import of products into Shopify, and I did not put in the meta fields the created date, and that sent the whole filtering system haywire, because you could no longer filter collections by newest in first or date added to the website, which was a really big problem for this quite large fashion brand. If I didn't have Rewind, that would have been a complete pickle. It would have taken hours, if not days, to sort out. All of the while, these products are live and really messing up their merchandising. A mistake by me, absolutely. But fortunately, I had the foresight to install Rewind before I made any of these changes. And I was able to just click a button, restore the site back to a previous version just a few minutes before I made that fatal error. And no one was any the wiser. That's the value of Rewind. That's just one use case, okay? One use case. There are hundreds of other use cases. Have it on there, because when you need it, you'll text me or you'll tweet me and say, thank you so much, Finn, for recommending that I install Rewind. You saved my bacon. Back to today's show.
So let's talk about, I mean, what are you seeing most at the moment? Where do you spend a majority of your time in your day-to-day with brands, with clients? What are you working on that's kind of par for the course for you?
Yeah, the most common three issues, I would say, or handful of issues, have to do with subscriptions. Like, yeah, there's federal and state laws about offering negative option plans, or any program where somebody is charged on a recurring basis unless they take some action not to be charged. The laws get very specific about what you have to tell people before they complete their purchase, what you have to tell them after they complete their purchase. And it's a very popular category of consumer class action, especially in California, because California is the most detailed in terms of what they require. So that's a big one. The example I gave at the beginning, discounted prices that are marked down from some fake original price, or the timing of the discount is wrong in such a way that it violates the federal and the state law. That's also very popular in California. I see at least one of those a week filed that comes through the tracker that I have for that. Using images, especially on social media, images and music that the brand doesn't have the rights to use. So, for example, a lot of times brands will think, like, if a photograph of our product or someone wearing our product exists either on social media or Google Images, then surely I can use that picture. It shows our product in it, and I can put it on our website or post it on Instagram or something. And that is not the case unless you have the rights to use the photo. And those kind of lawsuits get filed all the time as well. I think that was three. But then also there's a lot of attention being paid by regulators like the FTC to reviews and endorsements and websites that, like, rank different products and purport to be independent advertorial reviews and things like that. So the way that you solicit reviews for your products, the way that you present them, and the disclosures that you might need to make when you present them is a hot area for regulators. And we're also seeing some competitors sue each other about the use of reviews and things like that.
Can you just, I want to go into each of those in a moment, but can you can you give us a quick picture of if this is a battle, this is how I see it in my head. On one side, you have a brand or company, and on the other side, charging at them or charging at each other, you have a consumer and a regulator. Is there anyone else that's sort of out to get, you know, a brand or a company? I shouldn't say out to get, but to enforce the law. Consumer, regulators, who else is watching the space and sort of keeping things in check with the law?
Your competition is the third one there.
Okay. So can you just briefly explain how each of those, a consumer, a regulator, and your competition might look to bring a suit against you? As in, what are a typical situation for each?
Sure. So from the regulator perspective, if we just think about the Federal Trade Commission, there's a group of laws and rules that they enforce. One of them is from the FTC, the Restore Online Shoppers Confidence Act. That's basically the federal subscription law. So if they see they're suing Amazon right now for subscription issues with Prime. They see that some aspect or multiple aspects of the Amazon Prime subscription process don't comply with what ROSCA, the law, says. And so they launch, I'm not sure exactly how this one got started, but usually they'll do some investigative demand, try to reach a resolution probably. And then when that doesn't happen, they'll file a lawsuit and get started that way. If it's a consumer who's upset about or who's initiating that sort of claim, and they're in California, maybe they were surprised to see that they were charged after their free trial ended or something. So they go back through and look at the checkout flow and say, this brand didn't tell me what the trial renews at or when I had to cancel, or they don't let me cancel online. I have to call some phone number, or they didn't send me the confirmation email or whatever. And then the lawyer drafts up a class action lawsuit that essentially explains or alleges what the violations are, and they file it, and then that gets started that way. For your competitor, in the case where, like, one I was looking at this week was a brand was alleging that this other brand had run an advertorial, like, blog post looking piece of content that looked like it was some independent reviewer comparing brand one to brand two and coming out in favor of brand two. So brand one was like, what they alleged was, you've made these claims in this supposedly independent advertorial that we know you paid for, that's making claims about our product that aren't true, and also making claims about your own product that aren't true. And so under the federal law, the Lanham Act, we're suing you for false advertising because you're making claims about both your product and ours that aren't true, and it's hurting our business. And so they filed a lawsuit in federal court for that, and that's how that gets started.
Okay, perfect. And that's something that, just my last point, and that you can clearly see the issue, but I feel like we're getting to a time in marketing and advertising where it's borderline some of the time. Maybe it always has been, but it's not trickery. But, you know, the it's getting that way. It's gone from years past being a clever headline in the newspaper and a poetic way to sell the product in the copy, to much more advanced, much more engaged advertising and marketing, and it is deception in some degree, but obviously that example is extreme. But there must be a massive gray moat now of things that just are kind of okay, but are they really okay? I'm not sure. And what happens with those? They just get fought out in court?
I mean, you're right. Like, marketing is getting much more sophisticated as time goes on. Like, the whole process of buying something is much more sophisticated from all aspects. So there's a lot more opportunities to convey a message to a consumer before they make, or while they're making, a buying decision versus just like a TV spot or, an ad in a magazine or something. There's a lot more interactivity and ways that you can attempt to manipulate a customer, but that's what marketing is. Like, you're trying to convince someone, even the most above board marketing, you are trying to convince this person to spend money that they might not have otherwise spent. Like, that's what it is. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but there's certainly more ways to conduct that sort of influence and manipulation today than there was previously. Some things are pretty black and white, and there's not a lot of gray area. Like, if you sign someone up for a free trial and you don't tell them that you're going to charge them $100 a month 3 days from now, like, that's a problem. I don't think there's a lot of gray area there. But then where the gray comes in is in situations where you're trying to assess like an implied claim in an ad. So the general starting point for any law or for any advertising claim is that they all have to be truthful, not misleading, even if they're true, and substantiated. And so with an implied claim, the concept is if a reasonable, if a significant minority of reasonable consumers would take away a certain message from your advertising, then you, the brand, are responsible for that message, even if you didn't intend to convey it. So there can be gray there. It's like, would a reasonable person take that meaning from this ad campaign, or is that not reasonable
person nowadays? And how do you even classify a reasonable person?
Yeah, it's what that's sort of the tension is that a court is going to apply what a reasonable person is, and it's supposed to be an objective test. Like, but almost definitionally, how can that be something that's objective? Like, I'm going to remove all of my bias and pretend I'm like objective man and then look at this. But that's essentially what we're doing. And so at least at the beginning stages of a case, like a judge is going to initially make the call that, all right, is it plausible that a reasonable person could look at this ad and take this meaning away? The answer is like, yeah, that's plausible. Then we'll have a jury figure it out down the road if it gets there. But at some early on in the case, someone is making that call. And like, within that, is this, would a reasonable person take this message from this ad, and then would they care, and then has it caused damage to that person who believed it? That's really where the gray area is. And yeah, that comes up all the time. And there's so many cases that would seem frivolous to many people where a judge says, yeah, a reasonable person, maybe they would take that meaning from the ad and we'll let it go forward and see what they can prove. And there's others where it's the other way. Like, yeah, maybe that was a reasonable meeting, and a judge says, no, not even plausible, and that's out.
So my advice there for any brand listening is don't go for reasonable-ish claims about your product. Go completely unreasonable, and then you'll be fine. Just make outlandish claims.
That is safer, honestly. I should probably say, like, this is legal information and not advice and all that. I think most people get that. But yeah, if you're going to make a completely insane claim, then that probably is safer, as long as it's so obvious that you're joking. That is probably legally safer than something that could be interpreted multiple ways.
That makes sense. What springs to mind for me is the adverts that we get on UK TV, where it's often a beauty or cosmetic brand that has reached a consensus of 93% of men love XYZ because Y, or 98% of women say this product improved. And then at the bottom, it's always of the 649 people asked. And you know that they're just continually asking until they reach the percentage. And that, because it's always a different number, right? So It's like, it's still ultimately manipulation, just probably within the guidelines or within the law. So to that point, does the law actually work? Because it seems to me marketers and advertisers will always try and find ways around it. The law will always try and make it fair. I mean, what is the point of the law in these situations, would you say? What is the law?
Yeah.
Why is it there?
What we're trying to do, or what the law is intended to do, is to prevent a consumer from being misled and part with their money when they otherwise wouldn't if they had better or more complete information. And that also keeps the marketplace more fair, because we shouldn't have honest businesses losing their ability to compete with fraudsters. And if we don't have some ability to check this, then no one's going to be able to compete fairly because everyone's going to feel the pressure to do these black hat tactics or to just lie all the time. So it's from a trying to keep a competitive and honest marketplace and also trying to make sure people have good information when they decide to spend their hard-earned money. That's the lofty policy goal behind these consumer protection laws. Is it working? I mean, the law works, but it's certainly not perfect, but it's better than if we didn't have any of this. It works in some areas better than others. Like, for example, I think about influencer disclosures on Instagram and TikTok a lot, and how, you know, the rules are pretty clear. They've been clear for a long time. And still, you know, I can spend 5 minutes on Instagram, not even looking for it, and find what is clearly a piece of sponsored content that's not being disclosed. And it's like, the law is not working for that issue, or at least not working as well as it probably should. So, I mean, it works, but it's certainly not perfect. And non-compliance is always going to happen. It's just a matter of degree.
Which then opens up the door for people to bring the cases and the suits. And ultimately, it does work itself out, doesn't it? And yeah, gets to an end goal or resolve there. What do you a can of worms here? I don't want to go too deeply into this, mainly because I just don't know enough about it. But so you said about complete information, fairness of information, access to information, correct information, AI. When that starts to come into the conversation and we start to think about everything from search engines using AI to deliver better results for you, but that's based on information that's available. But that information might not necessarily have come from the brand. Could have come from, like we had in that example, someone writing a obviously unfair blog post about two products. But if someone not associated with the brand wrote that and put that on the internet and AI read it, then it might not know the difference. So we're talking about massive accumulations of data and information. What do you think about the evolution of AI in terms of the law, and do you see the cogs turning already about, oh, okay, we're going to need to have a step change here and work out how we're going to deal with this?
Yeah, there are so many questions that AI poses, legally and otherwise, that I don't think I'm smart enough to wrap my arms around all of the questions. Like, there's just so much that's going on. To the question about, is there activity from regulators' perspective about an understanding that we should try to get our arms around this before it gets out of hand? Yes, the FTC has released several press statements, and they've issued other public statements about how we need to have a set of guidelines and industry regulation so that these businesses that are developing and deploying AI understand that there are real rules they have to play by. Whether that's going to be effective at all remains to be seen. And this is all just sort of talk at this point and like warnings from the FTC. But issues with understanding what data AI models are trained on and whether the inputs are legitimate or even lawfully used in the copyright context and who is responsible or is anyone liable for the output that an AI makes? Like, can you defame, can an AI defame somebody if it was trained on defamatory information? There are so many questions that are very difficult ones. And I don't know how we're going to, I don't know if it's possible to pump the brakes on the pace of development with AI enough to even try to get answers to these before it's irrevocably out there. The issues that I've seen with AI so far in my practice have to do with things like deep fakes and brands using celebrity voices and ads and stuff like that. Those are like pretty simple issues in the grand scheme of what AI is capable of doing. But even there, like there's a sense that from some people who are very pro AI, that because AI is new technology, that means it must be unregulated and there must be no law that applies to it yet. And that's not the case. Like the laws about publicity rights have existed for decades. They apply pretty cleanly in these deepfake contexts. And so there's no like great leap that we need to do to have those laws apply to that situation. And, but that always happens with new technology, like with Web3 and NFTs, people thought, oh, it's the Wild West. We can do whatever we want because it's new. But it's a mistake to think that just because technology is new, that, that means you can do whatever you want. There's going to be, more likely than not, some set of laws that applies to how you're using that new tech.
You are in the D2C space. If you have a brand that's selling online and you haven't at least had a demo with Sendlane, then one of two things is objectively true about you. You like setting money on fire. You like making your life more difficult. If neither of those things are true and you are an e-commerce brand and you are selling online, you do send emails, you do send SMS, you do have reviews, or at least like to collect reviews, then there is no reason for you not to at least have had a demonstration with Sendlane. They are built for e-commerce. They are the most modern platform with the best features, in my opinion, at the lowest cost. I mean, I'm not really sure what would be holding you back. Please go and check them out. Show notes below, they have an event coming up. You can still get tickets, I believe, for that event in San Diego. A link to the Commerce Roundtable in the show notes below as well. Please do go and check out Sendlane if you haven't already. Back to the episode.
There was a story recently, someone we probably both know in this space, did an ad on Instagram, and then a competitor, so he says, I haven't seen the ad myself, but took the script and the voice of the person.
I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
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 And he got, you know, fairly upset with that. I think one of his first posts was, you know, see you in court type. I don't know what he actually said, but you know, it was along those lines. And I just wondered what is the likely fallout from something like that? In another example, like, is that against the law? One, two, if it is against the law, you know, is it older law like you were just talking about that protects a company in that situation, or is it one of these newer AI type guidances that say you can't do that?
Yeah, so it would be existing laws, and which laws would come into play depend a bit on the context. I can't remember exactly the specifics of that guy's case, which is, or situation, which is probably good because I don't want to talk
too deep into it. All right, yeah. keep it wild.
But let's say in a more simple example, there is some product that had taken Joe Rogan's voice. It was like a nootropic supplement. They made it sound like Joe Rogan was promoting that, instead of whatever his actual brand is. So the law that you're talking about there is Joe Rogan's right of publicity. And the publicity right exists. Every state has some variation of it. There's not a federal publicity rights law. So the precise way it works depends on what state you're in. But in California, everybody has the right to protect the commercial use of their name, image, voice, or persona. And if you use it commercially without my permission, even if I'm not famous, I have a claim for violation of publicity rights against you. So in that situation, Joe Rogan, he is famous and recognizable for his voice. Like, everyone knew, even if there was not a video part of that, everyone knows what Joe Rogan sounds like now, especially somebody who'd be interested in buying a nootropic supplement. And so that brand that was running that ad had pretty obviously violated that law because they've taken his voice. He's famous for his voice. They've used it commercially. They didn't have his permission. Arguably, he's harmed by that. His brand could potentially have a Lanham Act claim for false endorsement also, or he could have a claim for that because it sounds like he is not only, it's not just his voice being used in this ad, but he's specifically endorsing this product and misleading people, misleading consumers to the fact that he has some relationship with that brand when he really doesn't. So that's just like a couple of issues that could come up. And those aren't new laws. Those have been around for a very long time. If you were to take the entirety of like whatever Joe Rogan's brand's script is and just recreate that word for word, maybe he has, a copyright interest in that script or whatever that ad looks like. And that could potentially be another angle. Or there's some visual element of his own brand in that ad that's been taken and used incorrectly, and there could be some sort of trademark claim. There's a number of things that like immediately come to mind that aren't new to AI at all, but could be presented the way that people are using AI or the way that some people are using AI currently.
Does it often work? I mean, for me, when I first saw that, I just did a quick gut check and I was like, does that feel wrong to me? Yes, it does. It does feel wrong to me. It, generally speaking, if you can you trust your gut with law? If it feels like it's a bit, maybe that's a bit, you know, that's not right.
I think the gut check is a great first step to determining whether something needs some more review. And the way you put that reminds me of this situation where one of my friends who's also a lawyer, he does sort of what I do, but in-house at a big company. And he was talking to a third friend of ours, also a lawyer, who he was like half joking, but this third friend had come up with this scheme where he was going to make a website that solicited donations and like for a particular political party. And he was trying to like figure out a way where he would just siphon off some of the donations. And he was trying to say like, well, it's literally true. Like the donations do go to this project. So I'm not lying. And my second friend was like, listen, do you think you're being clever? If you think that your ad is like being clever or sneaky, like you should probably take a minute and then ask yourself if what I'm doing is illegal. So it's kind of that same comment. Like if you think that you're getting away with something or like you're being crafty, then it's possible that that means what you're doing is illegal. Not in every case, but certainly a good indicator of maybe I should get a second set of eyes on this or talk to somebody who knows.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think about it. Definitely. If you're a marketer and an advertiser, deception is never.
Yeah. Especially if you find yourself saying, well, it's literally true. Like that's likely going to be an issue.
You're already defending it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. If your pitch is defending it.
Yeah, probably not good. I did say we'd just bring it quickly back down to the three things that you mentioned. The first one was subscription. My question, the three things that you deal with quite commonly. My first one about subscription is this. You have plenty of applications, especially for tools like Shopify, that will give you the functionality to be able to do the subscription process. I would, as a reasonable person, think that they have done their due diligence, and included with that is everything that I'm going to need to be protected by the law. Is that the case for the majority of what you see?
No, that is not the case. So what I'll say first is that the responsibility is on the brand to ensure that whatever plugins they're deploying comply with the laws that you need to comply with. And so it's not the case that you can sort of just pass that liability on to some third party that's helping you out. I've seen many instances where there is some sort of plugin that's being used or some other app that is just not complying with California's law on subscriptions or maybe some other state's law that I'm looking at for whatever reason. Some of them do, some of them don't. I can't say off the top of my head, you know, this app for sure is not compliant or this one always is, because there's also to some extent an ability to customize how it's presented either within that or on top of it or in addition to it on your site. But it is a mistake to think that like just because this app exists, they must cover me. So another example of that is like there's third-party plugins that will claim if you put this on your website, you'll be ADA compliant, and you'll still get sued because that's not true. Like, and then good luck having that company defend you in those cases. So it's always worth verifying, especially if it has to do with the kind of issue that's very popular for class actions, which right now subscriptions are.
And I mean, I don't know if you have an opinion on this, but who would you traditionally say within a brand would be responsible for checking sort of things like that? Because, and maybe if you're a small brand, you know, it's going to be the founder. But if you're a slightly bigger brand, medium size, you don't have in-house legal representation, maybe you have an external legal representative part-time, but that's focused on much bigger things than checking subscription apps. Because I don't think a UI UX person is necessarily going to be too in tune with that. I don't think a marketing manager would be. Who would you traditionally say is the person that takes ownership for that in an organization?
If you have somebody who's in a compliance role, sort of generally, or maybe a CTO or some sort of technology officer, if you have somebody who already cares about privacy, maybe then they might also be interested in this sort of regulatory compliance as well. But you know, my business primarily is for those sort of mid-sized brands that don't have somebody, and they don't necessarily want to hire a big law firm who's going to charge big law rates to look at these specific things when they come up. And so that's where I can come in.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So we'll whiz through the other two. What were the other two that you deal with a lot? Have you got subscriptions? Was it ADA or did we already do?
I was talking about discounts and former pricing issues. And,
yeah, I'm interested about this. So what's the problem with that? Because I tell you now, I'm going to see a lot of this over Black Friday. There's going to be a lot of brands that inflate the price and then drop it down. So where's the green, where, you know, where's that okay? Because I'm a brand, I can set my price.
Sure.
You know, what's the problem with that?
Yeah. So the federal law on it is if any advertised former or reference price, like whatever is struck through, needs to have been the prevailing market price for a significant amount of time before the offer runs, which is not very specific language. In California, the law is that reference price needs to have been the bona fide, the actual price of the product for the 3 months preceding the sale. So if you look back 90 days and ask yourself, all right, we've struck through $100. Was that the prevailing market price, the like the real, so to speak, price for at least 46 of the last 90 days? If yes, then we can have that struck through and say, you know, now $50. If not, then you're violating the law.
And is that on your website only, presumably?
It's on your website or any advertising that you have any control over. So if you have a you know, an agency running ads for you on social media or something, or buying Google ads, you're still responsible for that advertising as well. If you have some rogue affiliate that's making some insane offer somewhere that you have no control over, then probably not liable for that.
I don't want to take this down the road of you giving specific examples, because I appreciate that, you know, need a lot more information. But for a fast fashion brand, for example, a company that has a lot of products moving through that they maybe would never stock again, that might decide to do a category wide, let's say, for example, shoes discount, but there's a product that they added yesterday and it's never featured on the website before, it won't again when they sell it out, but they decide that they want to do a category wide 20% discount, strike through all the category prices, 20% off, show a different price. Would that be technically illegal? I mean, it's so hard with this to give specifics, isn't it? But I'm trying to get an understanding of like a certain business that has a very fast turnover stock.
Yeah. Yes, that could be a problem with respect to those items that have not been offered for sale long enough for you to make that call. Like if this is a brand new product that has never been for sale before, I can't say that it's 20% off because it's never been offered for full price. And fashion retailers, I think Boohoo was probably the largest, if it's not the largest, settlement of one of these cases that there ever was. And that was last year. They were sued for this exact issue we're talking about, either fake reference prices or sales that went on for too long. And to settle the case, they agreed to pay $230 million. So it's a lot of money. And that's because they realized if they went to trial and lost, the downside would be so much more than that, that it was worth it to pay $230 million to not go to trial. So,
but presumably they won't change. I'm going to check their website, but presumably I don't think they'd have changed. I'm speculating, but I can't see how they would have, how that business model, they could get around that, because that is their bit. That's literally their business model. But
yeah, absolutely.
That's one of the ones where I think there needs to be like a sidestep law of, you know, but it gets too nitty gritty, doesn't it? So does the law, this is my final question, because we've got to wrap it up. But when it gets nitty gritty like this, when you get into business specifics or industry specifics, types of business, is there ever a situation where the law is going to be able to be like, okay, you know, because of your business model, because you work in this way, and this is how your business operates and has to operate, we will make this exception in these cases? Or does it just never really get there?
It can, not in the context of what we're talking about. Like that, there's no real exception for the reference price issue, no matter what business model you come up with. In other areas of the law, you will see like the law will be stated and then it will say, you know, subject to exceptions listed somewhere else. And then you'll have, for some industries, they're allowed to do something a little bit differently. Like, I don't remember the exact wording of this, but there was some law where, or proposed law where businesses that, they're essentially not allowed to surprise you with any fees when you check out on a website. So like if you're going to say advertise something as being the price of a product, you need to tell people the full price the first time they're shown it. You can't add service fees and stuff and then, inflate the number, but there's a carve out for, third-party food delivery services who don't have to initially tell you what the delivery fee is. Like once they realize the distance and things like that, then they can add it on. So that's just an example of, yes, from time to time, there will be sort of carve outs within a given law that accommodate a certain business model or industry. But it's really rare in the consumer context. It's rare that you'll see, and I'm not aware of anything like, hey, you know, we're in the business of selling things really quickly, and so we shouldn't have to be honest about what our pricing history is.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. And I wonder why that law exists to some degree, because, yes, I get that you're saying it was one price and now it's a lower price, and that has an intrinsic value of a customer expectation being higher for that product. But ultimately,
yeah,
the consumers just, they're going to buy it or they're not, and that will end up in a good review, a bad review, and the market would probably work itself out over time in that sense, mm-hmm. in terms of pricing, generally pricing, and markets tend to work themselves out if left untouched. So I wonder why there was the need to get involved there. Maybe it was people saying this was £1,000 and now it's 99p, sort of that kind of but then surely only idiots would be, I don't know. Who knows? Yeah,
I mean, the argument the brands will make is like, look, what's the harm? We said it was $60. You paid $60 and you got a product worth $60 because it was never sold for $100. So you got what you paid for. And I logically understand that argument, but I also know people like my girlfriend who's very susceptible to sales. Like, and it's not just her. I'm not picking on her by any means, but there's a lot of people out there who will see, they'll make a purchase because it's 80% off, because it's like, oh, you know, maybe I wouldn't have bought this, but it's only going to be 80% off for a week. And I kind of do like it. And so I'm going to make that purchase. And so whoever was behind drafting the law initially wanted to prevent people from spending based on some representation that wasn't true. It's like, there's not really a savings here. There's not really a discount. And if I wouldn't have made that purchase otherwise, then it's not fair to induce me to do that. And I'm sympathetic to that. Like, it, ultimately, you shouldn't lie to me when I'm deciding whether or not to buy your product. If it's good, I'll buy it for $80. If you do want to run a legitimate sale, great. Maybe I will be encouraged to buy it when it is Black Friday and I actually am getting 60% off or whatever it is. Like, those sales work because people believe in them. And so you shouldn't abuse that trust, basically.
Yeah, I do get it. Right. What it's been really fascinating and I've really enjoyed it. What's something that I should have asked you that might really benefit a business, a consumer business that's listening to this that I didn't end up asking you? Something that's top of mind for you right now?
Something that I was thinking about today, because someone asked me this, or I saw a comment on Twitter about this. Someone was making the pretty common comment that, you know, we don't like working with lawyers because they just tell us no all the time and we'd never be able to get anything done if we worked with lawyers. And I don't like seeing that comment, not because I take any offense to it, but because good attorneys shouldn't give you that impression. Like, what we're here to do, especially those of us that focus on things like assessing risk, is helping you understand what the risks are so that you can make that call yourself. Like, some clients are fine taking on a lot of risk as a business decision, and that's totally okay. But you need to understand like what the legal risks are so that you can make that calculus in the first place. So if I said no to everything that all my clients wanted to do that carried some legal risk, very few ads would be run. And so I see my job as understanding what the client's risk tolerance is and then bringing them in line, or at least their plans in line with that, so that they're not going to be surprised by something down the road.
That was Rob, everybody. I hope that was interesting. For me, it just raises more questions. I don't know how I feel about the law in general around these sorts of things. It's like almost like that free market argument of, would it just work itself out anyway? I guess not. We probably do need to have some parameters, but then where are those parameters set? One thing I don't really understand about the US is this whole kind of lobbying situation that goes on. Is that good or bad? Like, what do you think about that? The big companies being able to make certain changes just because of their influence. I mean, at least that's the narrative that I've been led to believe, especially through shows on Netflix, for example. But either way, you know, I'd love to know your sentiment on the law that surrounds consumer and the laws that surround e-commerce in general. Are we pretty much all right, or, you know, we're a little bit far away from where it should be? Let me know. Let Rob know. Anyway, check Rob out if you want to. This episode was brought to you by Sendlane and Rewind. Thanks to both of them. Do check them out if you haven't already. And we'll be back next week, as always, with another person from the e-commerce or consumer ecosystem for your listening pleasure. Thanks for tuning in.